welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Andrew Heaton. And today I'm going to speak to Lauren Chin. She's the host of Roaming Millennial Uncensored about the new right. We will discuss what the incoming crop of conservatives and Republicans look like, because they'll probably be around for a while. So it's a good idea to familiarize ourselves with it now. And also, my new producer, Jennings, has a surprise in store for me, which I'm sure I will enjoy, and you probably will as well. But before we get to either of those things, we do need to pay the bills, and that means a word to our sponsor. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by Spam Strangler, the service that not only blocks unwanted calls and emails from telemarketers and robocalls, it traces the signal back to their home and harasses those telemarketers at odd hours. We live in an era marked by busyness, and to a lesser extent, kale, which has inexplicably become a dominant grocery staple. In my opinion, kale's basically just an ugly stepsister of spinach trying to compensate being fancy and failing. But that's actually very incidental to the point of this. My main point is this. In this busy, hectic, kale-obsessed culture we live in, every bit of free time you have counts, and so does attention. Attention, like time and money and whales, is a limited resource. So when someone steals your time and attention, that's a problem. That's why I pay a small monthly premium to use Spam Strangler. I get at least 2 calls a day from unknown numbers wanting me to check an insurance policy or sign up for a credit card or pick up my nephew from a soccer tournament. None of these things apply to me, and they are infuriating. And that's why Spam Strangler is so genius. Install the app on your phone, and it automatically screens robocalls and telemarketers so that you never even know they tried to reach you. But Spam Strangler goes a step further. It taps phone lines to determine where those unwanted calls are coming from, find the parent company, and then it anonymously calls police departments to report domestic abuse at that location just to waste their time. Then, at night, specialists from Spam Strangler call telemarketers at home, personally, to yell at them, harass them, or just say, "You're unhappy because you deserve to be," at 3 o'clock in the morning before hanging up. Spam Strangler has 3 full-time detectives just figuring out who owns robocall firms, so it can track the owners down and do everything possible within the confines of the law to ruin their lives. Once identified, Spam Strangler doesn't stop until those robocall company owners feel like they're in some hellish Lovecraftian version of The Game starring Michael Douglas, just nudging them every day closer and closer to the brink of utter deranged madness. Spam Strangler. Buy yourself some more time, attention, and vengeance. All right, we're going to bring on our guest in a moment, but before that, Jennings has something of a surprise for me. Last week, we did not do listener feedback, and Jennings says that he has culled a fantastic bumper crop of feedback that you will tremendously enjoy, so much that we've actually put it at the front of the program, and we will blaze through that and then get on to our guest. Jennings, what do we got?
Well, Heaton, over the weekend, I actually sent out some emails and got a bunch of them back from some of your ex-girlfriends with some great listener feedback for you.
Oh, wait, hold on. I'm sorry, what?
Listener feedback. You wanted some...
I got that. Did you say that you contacted my ex-girlfriends for listener feedback?
Yeah, well, some of them. Sure.
Why would you do that?
I think it's important that you get some perspective given to you by people who maybe don't necessarily agree with you on everything, but really care about you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, but this, it's about the show. It's about the podcast.
It is entirely constructive feedback, Heaton. You have nothing to worry about. This is all stuff meant to make you better.
Okay. All right. Fine. Let's do this.
All right. So Bridget says, "I really enjoy the variety of viewpoints Heaton has on the show and how civil he is when interacting with people he doesn't necessarily agree with.
Nice.
I dislike that he looks like a Victorian meerkat when he takes his shirt off."
What does that mean? What does that mean?
I mean, it's, look, she's being very positive. She's saying that she enjoys that there's a variety of viewpoints on your show and you're very civil.
Yes, I got that.
And those are all really good things. I think, honestly, Heaton, I think you need to maybe check your ego a little bit here.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Please move on.
Okay. Katie says, "Sometimes Heaton struggles to find a point in his interviews. He always struggled to find things."
Which Katie was that?
Number 2.
Okay. All right. Please keep going.
Megan says, I really enjoy Kevin's podcast.
Kevin's podcast? Megan said that?
She enjoys the podcast. She enjoys it very much.
She enjoys Kevin's podcast. I don't know who Kevin is. Do you know who Kevin is? I'm Andrew. I'm Andrew Heaton.
I don't think you need to focus
on that. That hurts worse than the last thing, because at least they got my name right the last couple of ones before that. I'm not even sure she knows who your title is. Okay. All right, let's just keep going.
Susan says, it's nice that Heaton can have thoughtful, interesting conversations on his podcast about things which aren't him.
Okay. All right. That's
very positive. Very positive,
yeah.
Like I said.
Thanks. Thank you, Susan. It's nice to hear from you.
Latifa says, Heaton is so terrified of genuine human emotions that if he feels one for over a minute, he will reflexively shout something like Jack Handy quotes or Star Trek. I enjoy the commercials. # eat at Snuffies.
That was withering. That was just cutting remark.
Heaton, look. First of all, you need to check your ego. Like I said, you need to take it down a notch.
I feel like that was a mean statement masquerading as helping the show. But the onus of that was just being mean.
Look, she did help the show. She really likes our sponsor, Snuffies, which is a great restaurant, Heaton. It's a good restaurant.
It's a fine restaurant. All the waitstaff rides horses.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Please continue.
Moving on. Mindy says, I really enjoy the podcast. See, she's being positive. Yeah. You've got to take the good with the bad.
Yeah, okay, yeah. All right, well, that was good. Okay, that was easy.
Well, there's more. I think my favorite thing is that I can listen to an episode first before exposing it to my parents. That way, if the episode reeks of scotch and pipe smoke and seems like it might hit on my mother, I can play a different one for them instead of ruining Easter.
I almost married her. And this is what she's airing out. Okay, great.
Heaton, these are people who care about you. Obviously, if you almost married her, these are people who care about you, but who maybe disagree with you politically, let's say, and they're trying to give you good feedback on how to do the show better.
Okay.
I think it's good.
Okay, fine.
Moving forward. Beatrice says, Andrew's podcast could benefit from spending more time tightening the comedy sketches, just like Heaton would benefit from doing more push-ups. Dating Heaton is like making love to a baritone hat rack.
What? Okay, that is just awful. That right there, Jennings, that right there tells me that she stayed up at night writing mean jokes about me and that she selected that one, baritone hat rack. What does that even mean?
I mean, Heaton, honestly, I think she summed up in two sentences what we've all been trying to tell you for about 5 months.
Okay. How much more of this is there?
Let's see. I have a total of 36.
I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. We've got plenty of feedback. Thank you, ladies, for the feedback. Jennings, thank you for spearheading this project. I really appreciate that. We're going to move on. Bump, bump, ba-dump, bump, ba-dump, bump. My guest today is Lauren Chin. She is the host of Roaming Millennial Uncensored. We met maybe a month ago and got into an interesting conversation that we will, if not replicate, expand upon here, which was, who is the new right? And I don't know, because I am now in my mid-30s and don't really fit in any particular group. And it seemed to me that Lauren had a much better pulse on what people that are in their 20s and that cohort are kind of oriented towards politically. And that's important because we're going to be dealing with that group for a very long time. And so I wanted to see how that was. Lauren, thank you for coming on the program.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for having me. And it was great to meet you and the rest of the Blaze team. In I think January was the last time I was there.
Yeah, that was fun. It was fun. So I had not even heard the phrase the new right before. I did not know that there was such a thing. What is the new right?
Well, it's funny because I don't know. I feel like politically right now we're in this phrase where every little micro movement needs to have its own name.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the new right, it's actually it kind of all started with, I think, the 2016 election. And during that time, the phrase alt-right was being popularized. Mm-hmm. And now, I think right now, we all kind of know the alt-right as a movement of white nationalists who are ethno-nationalists, very much have a strong racial identity formed around whiteness. They're not actually even necessarily particularly right-wing when it comes to their economics, mm-hmm. But they are, you know, your quintessential white nationalists. Back in 2016, it sounds really strange. friendship, but the truth is the phrase alt-right was used a lot more loosely and was a lot less defined, specifically surrounding white nationalism. So, you know, back in the day, you had people like Paul Joseph Watson and Mike Cernovich being attached to the alt-right label, even though they are by no means white nationalists, just because people wanted to call this, I guess, new wave of right-wingers who are very different than the establishment GOP or the neocons. They just wanted to be able to distinguish them.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually when, I guess, people coalesced around alt-right having this white nationalist tendency and being associated with people like Richard Spencer, that's when the term new right was sort of coined to be able to say, all right, these people, they're different than the, you know, tiki torch holding Charlottesville people, but at the same time, still not your average neocon. So right now, when people talk about the new right, it's generally a younger generation of conservative activists, voters, and pundits who they are about as fed up with the establishment and GOP and neocons as people on the left are, by and large. And I think if we had to pick a few issues where they really distinguish themselves from maybe conservatives of older generation, is that they are, first off, not afraid to talk about the issue of race. And I don't mean that in the identity politics way that the left often means it. It's just that when we look at, I guess, older conservatives and politicians, when the issue of race comes up, they kind of balk at it. They don't even want to talk about it. They take the colorblind approach, like, no, let's just...
I have to say, I'm rather uncomfortable and slightly terrified, so I get it.
And that's totally normal. But when it comes to people in the new right, they're not afraid to talk about this. Okay, let's talk about why we have, you know, things like wealth gaps among people of different races. It's not because of systemic discrimination, like people on the left might say, but let's talk about the reasons why it exists. Let's talk about why so many communities, especially lower income ones, are segregated racially, even though there's no laws concerning it. Let's talk about why people who are African American or Hispanic are so heavily inclined to vote Democrat. Let's talk about those issues, because I think a lot of people, myself included, believe that if we're too afraid to talk about that, then it's kind of the end for conservatism and, you know, Republican Party, just the way that demographics are going. We need to be able to connect with voters who are not your quintessential. That's one of the biggest things. They're also a lot more populist, I think, than libertarians or
I would assume so, because, I mean, at this point, the data that I've read, I check polling periodically, and for people, kind of young people as defined in polls, tends to be between the ages of 18 and 29. So I am now not quite a young person anymore. And for people in that bracket of 18 to 29, the approval rate for Donald Trump's very low. It's about 25% last I checked. So I would assume that of the people that are remaining there that might otherwise be a Republican and had been a Republican or Republican leaning with, say, Mitt Romney, that have bolted, for the people remaining that are enthusiastic about Donald Trump, they probably are populist by virtue of that.
Oh, right. Very much so. And that's actually funny, because someone like Mitt Romney, other people like Jeff Flake, even John McCain, you know, God rest him, they were very, very much huge targets of the new
Ben Sasse, probably,
right.
Probably new right wouldn't like Ben Sasse then either.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Pretty much nobody at National Review would
so all
be
of,
a fan of.
In effect, all of my conservative drinking buddies in Washington are on the outs with the new right.
Unfortunately, yes. Mm. And actually, if you look at people like myself, and even you know, I'm really tight with the College Republicans United down in Arizona, having another event with them this coming month. The whole idea of neoconservatism and the idea that you can, I guess, export democracy and freedom love through military means, that's another way that the new right really distinguishes themselves.
I'm pleased in that regard. The populist thing you brought up, I kind of went, meh, not a fan of populism. However, I share the critique of the neocons, a kind of idea that we're going to nation build by bombing them. We'll find a nation to obliterate, and then we will rebuild it, and they will just reestablish themselves as a proper Hayekian free market Jeffersonian democracy. Because that's
first, got to level it, and step one, bombs. Step two, freedom of democracy.
Kill Saddam Hussein, and the whole thing will turn into Virginia with more sand. That's going to happen.
Yeah. And it's actually funny. I mean, I know you don't really, I guess, like to label yourself, and that's always hard, but I think you were mentioning you kind of lean more libertarian.
Yeah.
And if I think of the new right, it's funny, they're actually, when compared to establishment GOP, more libertarian in some ways and less libertarian in others.
Mm-hmm. I think across the board, young people are, I think, a lot more libertine, regardless of political affiliation, when it comes to particularly marijuana legalization. I don't know about other drugs, but marijuana, gay marriage, homosexuality in general, I would imagine immigration, that tend to be things that are libertarian, libertine, whatever. So that would not surprise me. I would guess that the new right is probably fine with gay marriage. It's probably not an issue.
Right. It's not something that really comes up very much. I think people in the new right have come like, yeah, all right, this is what it is. Even if you may not personally agree with it, it's not something that we should be trying to dictate people's lifestyles through law with. But you mentioned immigration, and that's actually something that the new right, I think, even more so than the establishment GOP, is very, very much for strong border control.
Yeah, because when you and I were talking, I was like, oh, I'm apparently like an arch cuck. I'm like the Duke of Cucks.
Yeah, I mean, that's unfortunately, that is the language a lot of the younger movements have chosen to adopt for their people who disagree with them. But yeah, immigration is a huge thing. And I think that kind of plays into the populist bent of it because, you know, I don't really see people on the new right, unlike the alt-right, saying, oh, no one can come in unless you maybe look like us or perhaps no one at all. No, that's not it. It's just that there's the populist and I would say nationalist approach that if immigration is going to happen, it needs to happen for the betterment of the nation as a whole and for the betterment of the lives of the citizens. If you are jobs and investment, then for sure. But at the same time, immigration is not a giant humanitarian program where you know, people can come in and take advantage of citizens, taxpayers' resources.
So then with say immigration then, because there, I do think I think we tend to get into this habit in America right now where we're very binary in our thinking, which I don't think is aiding anybody. So when it comes to immigration, progressives tend to be pro-immigrant. There are exceptions. People leave out the rather glaring example of Bernie Sanders, who is not an immigration proponent. Because he thinks that bringing in low-paid immigrants will hurt American wages. So his immigration policy is a perhaps more polite version of what Donald Trump is saying. It's not actually that removed from a policy perspective, although he probably didn't vote for the wall. But in general, progressives tend to be very pro-immigration. I think you've hit the nail on the head with a lot of it, where they view it as focused more on the immigrants a lot of the time, where it has to do with a humanitarian element. But when you get into conservatives, I do find that there are different camps. Like I know a lot of people that are, they're very big border hawks, but they're also pro-immigration. And I do not think that they're disingenuous in that regard. Having had several conversations now, they do think immigration's good. It strengthens America, all that kind of stuff. They just want to make sure that there's not a porous border. And that's kind of their principal concern. But then there are other people, and I would put, say, like Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump in this category, who are not pro-immigrant. And I say that because with the Trump administration, they've signed on to bills that have not been enacted that would drastically reduce the amount of not just illegal but legal immigrants coming in. So it would seem to me that
they would reduce the amount and also change the makeup of the immigrants who are coming. Mm-hmm. If you look at something like I think it was called the RAISE Act, they're trying to do away with the concept of chain migration and encourage skilled immigrants to move. And it's funny that they were called all sorts of names. Racist, xenophobic, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at countries like Canada and Australia, we actually have very successful point systems for our immigration systems. Mm-hmm. And it works. You attract people who want to assimilate, who share your values, who want to contribute economically. And I mean, up until I think this is probably not true anymore with Trudeau and kind of opening our arms to the world's refugees. But for a time under Stephen Harper, Canada, the average Canadian immigrant was more educated than a native Canadian, which I think is exactly what you want. If you can pick and choose, why not pick and choose the best you can get?
I would, as a United States citizen, I would love for us to be a brain drain on the rest of the planet. That sounds great.
Right.
And I will say that while I think the Trump administration is for lessening the amount of legal immigrants coming in, the point system that you mentioned, I don't think is some sort of weird racist dog whistling type thing. I mean, that is the point system is what they've got in Australia. I'm more familiar with their system where you get, you've got a graduate degree, you get 15 points. You've got a clean record, you get 3 points. There's various things to incentivize it so that it's designed around somebody having an economic impact upon entering the country, which I think is a fair discussion to have. And in general, I would more prefer that kind of system than chain migration and things like that. So with the new right, then are they sort of more of this point system-based immigration, or are they immigration skeptic, or are they the alt-right would be the ones that are like, nobody gets in unless they're from Sweden.
But exactly.
The new right's exactly. Like, they can come in, but they need to know engineering. Like, where are they at?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. They can come in, but you need to be a net benefit to the country, and you need to do it legally. Absolutely. And I think there's also the issue of, you know, numbers definitely matters, because I think even in Canada, which I would say in the past overall had been successful.
And you're based up there, right? Are you in Toronto or Montreal?
Montreal. The French part. So we've had a successful immigration system in terms of people coming and succeeding economically, but we can't get away from the issue of numbers as well, because no matter how successful the immigrant group is, if you let people in enough with numbers where they're able to form their own, I guess, diasporas, there's no incentive to assimilate. So right now, like, we have a Chinese population, particularly on the West Coast. And you know what? I'm Chinese, clearly have no problem with Chinese people. But because there are so many of them, you know, you have entire neighborhoods where everything's in Chinese. People aren't learning English. People aren't absorbing the culture. So I think you can't, skills aside, you also have to have the numbers conversation.
Which I think is a fair conversation. I mean, I am, right. I'm going to say I'm sort of temperamentally inclined towards a Star Trek world where we can all hop borders and whatever we want. However, that is a thing where there's a certain amount of folks coming in, which I would increase from our present levels, that would be able to assimilate, I think, very quickly. And generally that does happen in the United States with immigration historically, as people are excited to come here. They're excited to be American. However, were you to drop in, say, 1 million people into Wyoming, I don't know that they would automatically adopt Wyoming traffic laws. I think right. that it would be more apt that there'd be – so – okay. All right. You mentioned libertarians a minute ago. When I was in college, there was the, I think, Young Americans for Freedom or YFP. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, I think they're still around.
Are they? Okay, yeah. There was some group that was sort of affiliated with a conservative movement. There was college Democrats. There was college Republicans. I don't recall the University of Oklahoma, my alma mater, having a very big libertarian movement, or maybe I was just unaware of it at the time. I don't know. But it sounds like you're involved in these college groups. What do are young libertarians, are they spillover that left from the you know, the conservative groups? They don't want to be a part of the new right, so they become libertarian. They're kind of micro Bill Weld characters, or where are they kind of today?
Well, I think in terms of college groups, there's the Young Americans for Liberty, who okay. I think Cliff Maloney is at least one of the people who heads that up. I was on a panel with him at Politicon. But what I find interesting about libertarians is that I went through my libertarian phase after my neocon phase, strangely enough. But what I notice about so many young people, especially maybe 20-year-olds who identify as libertarian, we've kind of gone away from just the idea of, like, very limited government, the only legitimate role of government to protect your right, to honestly full-on anarcho-capitalism in some ways, which is very, very strange for me to see how that's really blossomed among libertarians. Some of the, I guess, places like YouTube, Reddit, 4chan, where the young people hang out. Some of the biggest libertarian communities that operate there are, like, I would say, full on anarcho-capitalists. So you're kind of not even.
So in describing this forthcoming wave of 18 to 29 year olds, we've got the new right, who is populist, and the libertarians, who are anarchists. And the Democrats, who I assume with the 18 to 29-year-old block are you know, pinko socialist
characters.
Probably
literally communists wouldn't.
As soon as they hit 30, I just go, like, live in a cabin by myself. I don't think there's any role for me in this brave new world you describe, Lauren. I'm a bit nervous about this.
Well, that's the thing with young people, right? Young people are passionate. We want revolution. We want change. So this is very... If you look at any
Edmund Burke is never a really popular character on college campuses. The idea of a procedural conservative very concerned with parliamentary norms in order to assure gradual incrementation of positive change in society, that is not fitting on a T-shirt. You know what does? Che Guevara. You put him
exactly.
on a T-shirt,
Revolution
you get laid.
Now, raise fists, exactly. So, yeah, if you look at the political landscape among millennials and Gen Z right now, it might be a little bit scary, but I think what's going to happen is what always happens. As people get older, they become, by and large, more moderate with their views and kind of generally more conservative. mainstream conservatives. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, as scary as things might look now, we're also just living in a very, I think, politically polarized time. Yes. I don't think this is going to be the norm maybe 20 years from now. Oh, heck,
I agree. I think it would be astonishing if all current political trends just happen in perpetuity over the next 20 years.
Right.
That would be there are going to be some curveballs in there. And I think you're right as well, not to unfairly slag people in college. But I remember when I was in college, I just had this sense. I went to a couple of protests, which were not the existential, spiritual, religious ecstasies that they are now. But I went to a couple of them, and I was asking, for example, I went to one that was opposing Darfur and the genocide that was going on in Rwanda. And I wasn't trolling. I just kind of walked around. I was like, I'm sorry, I don't fully understand what we're doing here. Like, we're all against the genocide, but are we protesting the American government's response? And no one really had an answer. And I kind of got the impression by the end of it that the point of the exercise was that people kind of wanted to get out and like have a important moral thing to really thump their fist on a table, which good call in the case of Darfur, very bad situation. Mm-hmm. But I walked away with the idea that like, you know, if we ran out of stuff to be really angry at, most people in college would find new stuff to be really angry about, because that it's such an empowering sense of grandiose self-righteousness that you don't really experience when you're in middle school and you get into college.
Right.
And you're like, let's get under a banner and start the revolution.
It's teen angst by any other name, right? Mm. And what's so interesting to me is that usually these sort of, political polarizations happen during times when people are economically depressed, which makes sense. If people can't, feed their families or whatever, they get upset, they get frustrated. But if we look at what's happening now, when things are more polarized than they've been in a long time, things are actually going really great for most people in terms of having more money in their pockets, having a job, confidence.
Unemployment rate is down.
Exactly.
Most of the economic indicators are pretty good.
Right. So it is strange to me that despite that, we still have such a almost like this impending sense of doom among so many young people.
Yeah.
Especially if you look at someone like AOC, my girl, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she kind of talks as if the average middle class or even working class person is literally, begging for scraps on the side of the street, the way she paints the American economic system.
And that's terrible. They should be standing in socialist bread lines. That's where we want to
exactly,
be.
Exactly. Much better.
Bread lines wrapped
organized
around the street where the government's taking care of you because it imploded the economy. I think you're right about that. I had a guy on last week, and Brian Brushwood, we were talking about AOC, and we were talking about kind of doomsday prophesying. And in general, if you're an optimist like me, you come off like you're selling insurance or a new you come off like a salesman, and you're not if you're very optimistic, you don't seem like you have moral gravity to you. Whereas mm-hmm. if you are constantly talking about the end of the world in whatever capacity, then you're a person to be reckoned with, and people should stop and listen. And we tend to just like doomsday prophets too; they're more fun. We're all gonna die again. Better T-shirt than a T-shirt I make that says like, "Hey, 4% growth, pretty good. Want to play volleyball?" That's just not as much of a entrancing thing to bring everybody in on.
As an activist, a community organizer, it's easier to mobilize people when they think this is an existential threat, whatever the problem you're lobbying mm-hmm. against might be. It's very hard to get people excited and passionate and committed to your cause when you're saying things are pretty good now, but they could be marginally better. Like, that's not going to get people off their butts.
Yeah. Things are pretty good now, but they could be marginally better. I might make a mug that I keep on set that has that. But I agree that would be tough. Do you find, what is your read on the sort of levels of pessimism versus optimism in millennials, in this 18 to 29 block, or I guess that's millennials and iGen, but sort of the young demographic? Are they doomsday, or are we all going to die? Are people buying green bananas?
Very, very pessimistic. And I think that applies to young people across the political spectrum, because if, like I said before, you look at the progressives, the AOC type, they're convinced that the working class is being exploited economically by the bourgeoisie. As the 1% get richer and richer, everyone else is getting poorer and poorer by comparison, which they don't really talk about. But yeah, so they're convinced that the whole system is rigged. And even if you look at people like the New Right, this is very true. And you know what? I can admit that maybe I myself do it a little bit. They take issues that I think are real problems, like illegal immigration and yada, yada, yada. And it's very easy to take specific instances of, let's say, you know, terrorist incidents in Europe or MS-13, crimes in the U.S. or things like voter fraud. And it's easy to look at all of these little things together and say, all right, that's it. Like, the country's done our, you know, the border doesn't exist. We've lost all sovereignty. And, you know, the elections are completely rigged now because we're not able to control who's voting. It's easy to go down that rabbit hole. And I think just it's, again, the youth mindset in general is that things are so bad now, we need a revolution. I think young people, that may be the only thing they can agree on, by and large. We may disagree on why it's bad and what the revolution should be, but all of us are pretty largely in agreement on that.
Conversely, like, I'm at home, like, reading Steven Pinker going, I can't wait till the singularity comes. I'm going to get to play Age of Empires 2 on the deck of the Starship Enterprise with my family of sex robots living on the moon.
Yes,
this is great. So, like, I'm generally bullish on all of this, but I think that that's I think that's not even a young person thing. I think that's human nature, where we gravitate towards the negative far more than we gravitate towards the positive. We also gravitate towards the novel and the flashy far more than we gravitate towards the slow moving slight statistics. So, for example, more people die from errant champagne corks every year than from shark attacks. But if you were to ask the average person to, like, rank in order of death, shark attack, heart attack, errant champagne cork slipping in the bathtub, we would probably design, or we would write out a system that has very low bearing on society or on reality, but is nonetheless hooked into all of our visceral reactions as a human being. And I think that probably compounds as you get older. I suspect that because we all have these, something bad happens at some point in our life where we see something bad, we see a robbery, we see something terrible that lodges there. And I think it kind of impacts the lens through which we interpret data. So I feel like you have to kind of work to remain an optimist and and see the good stuff. Otherwise, it sort of encroaches in on you. So bad news for the early millennials, because they're already off to a bad start on that.
That's such a true point, and I've actually thought about that myself. And each side of the political spectrum has their own issues that they like to make up to be really big, but when you look at the grand scheme of things, really aren't that huge of a deal. Or at least the other side would argue, right?
Yeah.
For the left, it's maybe something like gun control. For the right, it's the, you know, scourge of illegal immigrants just killing citizens.
Yeah.
I think in both cases, it's not that, yes, those things are bad, but we do have to admit objectively, if you look at the numbers, not the most pressing issue that might kill us, but I think it's the idea that it's uncontrollable that makes people afraid, that it's outside of the norm. Because, I mean, things like drunk drivers, car crashes kill so many more people, but it's like, this is the new scary thing. This is different. This is something else that we're not used to, and that's what makes it even more scary, even if by just raw numbers, it's less of a threat.
That's a very good point. The lack of control, I think you're right. That had not occurred to me, but I think that that is a dominant thing there. That might, part of the reason people fear sharks is that you don't have a lot of control over shark behavior. But that makes a lot of sense to me too. And I'll add that I think a part of that is that we've got, we do have these lenses, these heuristic models that are at work in our us, and everybody has them. You can't get away from them. And the conservative heuristic tends to be civilization versus barbarism, or civilization versus entropy. And because of that, because the sort of the lens through which conservatives are interpreting data. And again, I want to state this, so are libertarians, so are Democrats. They just have different models. It's not like this is some sort of psychosis. Everyone has a lens. But it tends to be civilization versus other, or civilization versus entropy. And so you look at, like, a border situation, that's hitting all those lights internally of, this completely feeds into the meta-narrative of, you know, us against the incoming hordes and that kind of thing. Whereas I'm looking at the data going, you know, like illegal immigration's down considerably, has been down for a while. It's been, you know, on the net exodus since the Bush administration. And same with liberals, I think, with the heuristic is always there's an oppressor and a victim. Always, 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 always. There's an oppressor and a victim, and we will find one if there's not. And so when you're looking at a situation and you have to figure out where there's an oppressor and a victim, you get these situations where people are sort of leaping over each other to establish that they're a victim because you don't want to be the oppressor. I myself am always the oppressor. This is what I've learned the last few years. I am always the oppressor. There's nothing
just
I can do about
win.
It. Uh, but To back up a little bit, you mentioned gun control, and that was one of the things that I do see a trend in, and I could see that being a long-term trend. I've seen different data on this, but when the, I think it was the Harvard Young People poll that came out last year, which, so far as I know, they're not just interviewing people at Harvard, which if that were the case, would greatly skew this. But the data they had is that 77% of young American voters, again, 18 to 29, say that gun control will be an important issue for them. 47 of them support amending the Second Amendment. I looked at that and went, wow, if about half of the people are in favor of that, I don't know that that's necessarily a young person thing, because I could see growing up in Oklahoma, there are tons of people. I don't go hunting, but I have a lot of friends that, you know, grew up hunting and that kind of thing. So when they were 18, 19, 20, I don't think that they would have been more receptive to gun control in the same way that they might be receptive to redistribution of wealth or, you know, a nanny state or something like that. What is your read on that? Do you think that's going to change long term?
Well, I think gun control is an issue where even among people who are conservatives, if they're younger, they are a lot more open to things like gun control. Mm-hmm. You know, President Trump with the whole issue of the bump stock ban, I didn't really see a lot of young conservatives, at least the ones with larger followings, fighting him on that very hard. Where if you look at maybe an older crowd, definitely people who support and affiliated with the NRA, they're very much opposed to that. So I think that is a very, very interesting thing that perhaps separates them, again, away from libertarians or establishment GOP. Mm. I think just overall, the young people growing up with images of gun violence and things in Chicago, in Detroit, hearing horror stories from places, Missouri, we very much associate gun with crime, which I think if you look objectively at things like gun control laws with homicide rates, that's really not the whole picture there. There are a lot of other factors at work, but young people...
Gun control and gun rights is, I'm going to say from merely a statistical point, is incredibly complex in my experience.
Right.
And everyone wants to boil it down to basically one of two anecdotal maxims, relying on what they view as common sense. And it's common sense is just a pithy way of saying what I already believe. It is definitely more complicated than that.
And I would also say that I think when it comes to gun control, especially, that ignorance plays a huge part in why people are so supportive of, quote, common sense gun control. You have people like David Hogg saying, oh, you know, if you've been convicted of domestic assault, I'm sorry, but you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. It's like, yeah, you can't. That's already a thing. Yeah. We already did that.
Yeah.
So I think if actually people were a little bit more informed about what it actually takes to buy a gun, especially in these liberal areas where it's nearly impossible to buy a gun, they might be of the sense that, oh, okay, we are already doing things. It's just that criminal's gonna criminal by and large.
A minute ago, you mentioned that we're in a polarized time right now. I had a guest on a couple of months ago who posited that we're not actually more polarized, we're better sorted, in that there aren't, you know, a lot of conservative Democrats left, there aren't a lot of progressive Republicans left, there are a ton of independents. I'm curious, we definitely are more animated right now, and I think young people in particular are a lot more political. Do you think that that's going to burn out, or is that trend likely to continue where people are, you know, if they're young Republicans with MAGA hats, then this is like a giant football game. And if they're young Democrats with AOC, it's like joining a fledgling religion. Is that intensity of partisan identity apt to follow?
Well, it's funny that whenever the issue of polarization comes up, I think a lot of people don't really know what to make of the current state of affairs. Because if you look at the news or on social media, it seems like everyone's just like 2 seconds away from declaring civil war.
Yeah.
But if you talk to your average everyday person, they probably don't even, you know about all of the online fights that are happening between like such and such representative or celebrity, whatever. Most people. He's actually done a piece about this, one of these, I forget if it's Pew or Gallup or anything, but a poll that has tracked the average views of conservatives and liberals for decades, right?
Yeah.
And if you look, by and large, a conservative now, or the Republican Party now, isn't too different than it was, let's say, 30 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Care about things like economic freedom, border control, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at the left, the Democratic Party, they are actually going further and further left. That's not, if you think that you're not being crazy, the left is getting more radical. And I think we can see that if we just listen to people.
Yeah, and just from a policy perspective, that checks out as well, because it's right. like as little as 6 years ago, if you said to a senator who's a Democrat, like, are you in favor of a $15 minimum wage federally? They would get offended and be like, absolutely not. And the fact that you would categorize me in that, you know, economic category of not knowing what's up is just insulting. And most Democrats don't think that either. And whoop, they've all kind of got on board the Bernie train.
And it's the same thing with something like border control in terms of like a fence or wall, whatever you want to call it. You have people like Pelosi and Schumer who were previously supportive of this. Same thing, like Barack Obama previously spoke very hardly against illegal immigration. Now they're of the opinion that, oh, what, if we try to build a wall, that's the equivalent of, like, murdering Nicaraguan children? Are you serious? But no, it's absolutely true. So to your question of, is this sustainable, what's going to happen? I think the more that this happens, the more that it does alienate people who are, like, they're still left-wing. By no means are they conservative, but they're just not far-left people.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to happen more and more until eventually we see more of some sort of correction. I think we're at the point now where it's still getting worse, but it will get better.
I think you're right about that. I used to live in Britain, and a guy that I was talking to, because, you know, they've got like soccer hooliganism over there, and they've got to be real careful about how to organize these fights. I talked to one guy who was like, why don't we just have a section to the stadium for drunks to fight each other, and the rest of us can, and that's kind of how I feel about politics right now, where I feel like there's a loud, angry contingent of Democrats and a loud, angry contingent of Republicans, and about 80% of the population is going, I was going to read my Steven Pinker book and think about being on the moon, and like that guy was going to mow his lawn. There is the exhausted majority that's not participating in this, but the media only tends to cover those extreme ends of it because they're more fun and flashy and loud. And so we get this hyper-partisan, hyper-polarized view that's really not indicative of the rest of the country. I would wager, based on that, I don't have these figures in front of me, but I would imagine that the general trend of Americans going independent over Republican and Democrat, that's probably accelerated with millennials.
Yeah, I think that is actually accurate. And it's funny, when we talk about being independent, I think a lot of people might think, oh, everyone's a centrist. But no, if you probe independents about their policy views, pretty much everybody is kind of markedly to the right or to the left. We all have political opinions. It's just that you have a large amount of people who are just very fed up with the two-party system.
Yes, yeah. I think you're very right about that, because the data that I've read indicates the same thing, where we don't know the actual amount of true independence and the sense of people that are apt to pivot from Republican to Democrat or third party on a regular basis,
right.
Maybe around 10%. But there is a strong contingent of people that are probably going to vote Republican or Democrat most elections. However, it's a degree of how much they hate the party itself or how much they don't want to be associated with it, which I take as an incredibly positive sign, because my position is a pox on both your houses. They're both awful. I would love for the Republican and Democratic parties to just implode and let the rest of us pick up the pieces and do something more productive.
Well, I think it's funny when you look at people like AOC, who are kind of like, they're primarying their own party members to get in, and the amount of turmoil within the Republican Party between people like the Trumpers versus the McCainers and the Romney types. It's almost like the two parties, they're not actually two parties. It's like they're two camps with all these little micro parties within them.
I think you're 100% right about that. The term coalition, which is frequently used, is a far better description than party. The Republican Party is a coalition of neocons, the new right, libertarian-leaning Republicans, the moderates, although they've been in steep decline, and a few others. And it's the same with the Democrats. There's the environmentalists and the technocrats and the populists and all these different groups that are
Blue Dog Democrats, the literal socialists in some cases. Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. In the same, like I've had several friends that worked for Blue Dogs or were Blue Dogs. They don't have a lot in common with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Mm-hmm.
In much the same way, I would posit that, say, a Rand Paul character has very little in common with Roy Moore. Really only agree on taxes in general should be lower. But beyond that, I don't see a lot of philosophical overlap.
And it's interesting to me, if you look at the whole issue with who's going to be the Democrat candidate in 2020, the way people are attacking Tulsi Gabbard, I think should be very clear indication that, no, the parties, especially on the left right now, are not unified. They are going after their own like nobody's business.
I think that you're, given that there's like 187 Democratic nominees right now, you and I might be Democratic nominees. I haven't checked
to see if
we've been drafted or anything. I think you're going to see a lot of infighting. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out as well, because Tulsi Gabbard represents probably the least interventionist candidate, at least within the Democratic Party. Trump, I would say he is a muscular isolationist in that he, in general, doesn't want to go gallivanting in other countries, but he does want to build more tanks. Whereas Tulsi Gabbard, I think, is I don't know if she wants to decrease military spending or not, but she definitely wants to pull out of a lot of different countries. And it'll be interesting to see how the Democrats respond to her, because the sort of psychological defaults that we have these cartoons that we have, that Republicans care about lessening spending and Democrats care about peace, are really very loosely tethered to the actual voting record of both groups. The Republicans are very much opposed to spending and deficits up until they're in power, then they're fine with them. The Democrats are they're all against war until given the opportunity to vote for one. Then they tend to jump on board, and they're all like, okay, great, let's go into Iraq and Afghanistan. And seeing how they respond to Gabbard will be very interesting to get a pulse on how they operate. Before you go here in a minute, because you probably graduated college more recently than I did. I graduated in 2007. I dimly recall, I do not remember your political party or political affiliation being like a religious affiliation, which is kind of how I feel it is now, where a lot of people, they don't really care what religion you are, but they very much care what political party you are. By the time you show up on the scene, and I think you're in your early to mid-20s, I think, was that the case, or is that something that's overstated in my mind, but in all actuality, no one really cares on college campuses? What was your read of the pulse there?
So I graduated 4 years ago, and, you know, I was pretty active in, I guess, the political scene. I was in the College Republicans. I did, you know, an internship up on the Hill. But I think you're right. If I look at college campuses now, it seems like everything has been turned up to, like, 10, 13 on the dial. Before I was there, it was like a 5. People were still politically active and interested, but it's like, you know,
like when I was there, you could still get drunk and make out with somebody you disagreed with. That was still on the table. I feel like that's been removed.
Yeah, exactly. We had our College Republican meetings and, you know, speakers and stuff, and nobody really cared enough to try to protest. I mean, you might get like a flyer ripped down every now and then, but people certainly weren't trying to get speakers banned. And, you know, I was in a case personally where my comparative politics professor was a self-avowed Marxist. Like, that's how he described himself. But I still felt comfortable enough to kind of, you know, challenge him when I thought, and you know, we'd have back and forth, and other people in the class would chime in. And it wasn't universally everyone was just pro-left. But I've been back to campuses to give talks. A lot of my subscribers and viewers are in college themselves now, and they share stories of how bad it is. And I think absolutely things are a lot different than when we were there.
Okay. Well, so final question. Given that the conservatives are moving more populist, the Democrats are moving more socialist, and the libertarians are moving more anarchist, am I going to be okay, Lauren?
I don't know. That's hard to say. You know what?
Right. I appreciate your candor.
In 5 years, we may be in the situation where the country has fallen apart and everyone's just in little city states, which actually I don't think is the worst idea ever. But yeah, who knows what's going to happen at this point?
Oh, I meant more like, is everybody going to like me? But I like that you're bringing it to a broad level. I like that you're bringing it to a meta level for the benefit of my listeners, too. So I think overall we'll be okay. I think that a lot of it, I think that the ongoing trend for many of us is that as the boxes get smaller and tighter and more homogenous, fewer of us fit in them. And so I think a lot of us are going to kind of spill outside of the existing confines and maybe not have a super good label. And that'll be slightly uncomfortable for us, but also maybe we'll have better barbecues. I don't know. Either way, Lauren, I very much enjoyed talking to you. Thank you for coming on and kind of spelling this out and mapping it out for us.
For sure. Thank you so much for having me.
Mm-hmm. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/Mighty Heaton or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out on Fridays. I did not last Friday. I'm sorry. I will send it out soon. Or Maybe, I don't know, if you really wanted to get in contact with me, maybe you could date me for a few months, have a pregnancy scare, then wait a few years and contact my producer to say mean things about me. Maybe that's what we're doing now. I don't know. Take your pick. Either way, I'd like you to subscribe to Blaze TV and download the Blaze TV app. If you do, you can watch me instead of just listening to me. Use the promo code HEATON to get $10 off your annual Blaze TV subscription. I look like I should be chasing down the mummy with Brendan Fraser. So download Blaze TV app on iTunes or Google Play, get subscribed to The Blaze, and then fall in love with me more than you already are. You can also watch portions of the show on Facebook Watch by going to facebook.com/HeatonTV. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. That helps other people find this political orphanage. Thank you, and good day.